From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, with GM announcing new plant closures, we look back at how the closing of its Janesville factory affected that city.
Later, business leaders and philanthropists Donald and Donna Baumgartner talk about why they're so supportive of the city's arts organizations.
The arts are the soul of this community, and it's very important to me, and it's very important to Donna.
I mean, the people that line up to see the Milwaukee Film Festival, the crowds that come to keep the museum thriving and the ballet thriving, I mean, these are important things to have.
And two organizations come together at UW-Milwaukee to organize an artistic exhibition spotlighting a sometimes overlooked community.
You know, I haven't seen too many exhibitions specifically for trans and non-binary people, and it was especially important to have an empowering exhibition for this month.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. General Motors has announced plans to idle 5 factories and lay off as many as 14,000 production floor and salaried workers in North America as it tries to cut costs ahead of changing market conditions.
For people in one southern Wisconsin city, it is a sadly familiar scene. In December of 2008, General Motors shuttered its nearly century-old assembly plant in Janesville, Wisconsin. The resulting ripple effect led as many as 9,000 people in the city and surrounding communities to lose their jobs.
Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein put that factory closure in a broader context with her 2017 book called Janesville, An American Story. The book examines what first led to Janesville's heyday, the aftermath of the GM plant's closure, and explores why it is so difficult in cities like Janesville to rebuild a stable working class. Speaking last year by phone from Washington, Goldstein explained how Janesville first got on her radar screen.
I heard about Janesville probably early 2009. When I was actually looking for a setting for a story that I was doing for the Washington Post. And somebody mentioned to me that there was this Wisconsin town I'd never heard of before that had just lost a very old, very large General Motors plant. And at the time, I didn't go to Janesville because the closing was new, and a lot of the people who had worked at General Motors were still getting union subpay, good unemployment benefits through the GM contract, as well as their unemployment benefits. The economic pain hadn't really begun to sink in for a lot of people, so I didn't do that story in Janesville. But when I began thinking about doing a larger piece of work, looking at what happens to an ordinary community when a lot of its best jobs go away, Janesville lingered in my mind.
So you started writing the story in 2011, but the book really starts in 2008, before the GM plant shuts down.
That's right. So I began doing the research for this book and making trips out to Janesville in 2011. I first stepped into town the summer of 2011 and started getting to know the community, understanding what had happened there, understanding what these job losses meant to people. And as I was doing this, basically reporting, as I would do for my regular job at the Washington Post, I began to talk to people about what had happened before I showed up, because, as you say, the plant closed 2 days before Christmas of 2008, so I needed to understand what had preceded my arrival in town.
It was really interesting reading this book because I'm actually from a small town sort of near Janesville. And at times in high school, you know, we had these rivalries with one of the high schools called Janesville Craig. Of course, I wasn't aware of who Joseph A. Craig was or how he had transformed the city. And as the story progresses, we really see how transformative that one act bringing the GM plant to Janesville. It really was. Were you surprised by the sheer impact the plant had on the city?
Well, I was struck that for a fairly small city, Janesville has not one but two iconic industrialists who really shaped both the economy and the identity of Janesville. And the first person was the man who founded Parker Penn, which also was based in Janesville. He founded this little pen company that grew and grew in the 1880s. So by the turn of the century, Parker Penn was already reaching into international markets. So the small city of Janesville had, even by then, a sense of itself as reaching to the wider world. And then, as you say, Joseph A. Craig came along. He had been the guy who was running a farm implements manufacturer. And the man who at the time was the head of General Motors, a man named Durant, knew that he was a good businessman and wanted to hire him. So he invited Joseph A. Craig to Detroit one day to have a meeting about whether he was going to hire him. By the end of that meeting, Craig had persuaded the head of General Motors to move into Janesville. And the first thing that was made at the Janesville Assembly Plant starting in 1919, a long time ago, was tractors. And then in 1923, the first Chevrolets were being made. So this was an assembly plant that had a long, deep history in town.
Something that's interesting, I think, for Wisconsinites especially, is when outsiders come and look in. As I'm sure you kind of learned when you were in Janesville, we tend to be a little insular. How did you forge the relationships with the people in the book? Because they share such intimate details of their lives. It seems like something you might not tell someone you don't know that well.
Well, I forged each relationship one at a time, and I didn't ask people the most intimate things up front. So I first paid a visit to town and had tried to learn before I arrived who were a few people who might be really important for me to start to get to know. So I met with a longtime journalist in town. I met with the man who was the head of the job center, the Southwest Wisconsin Workforce Development Board. And I met with people who were running the United Auto Workers Local 95. There were two retirees who were the president and vice president of the local at that point, since the workers were no longer in their jobs to be running the local. There were retirees doing it. And I just began to talk to people about what had happened and why and what their experiences were like and what they saw having in town. And each person I met, I asked, who else should I get to know? And I was really grateful that people, you know, were willing to share their experiences with me. You know, one of the things I said to people was that I really wanted to explain to people who hadn't been through this kind of an economic trauma what really happens when work goes away, what happens to families, what happens to a community. I mean, I really wanted to learn these things, and I was grateful that people were generous in sharing with me what had happened to them.
And that's another kind of idea, this idea of an economic trauma. I know when I've tried to explain to people, I went to school in the East Coast, when I've tried to explain to people there what it's like to live in a town like Janesville or Kenosha, another town that I lived near, they don't quite get it. When you started explaining the kind of concept for this book to people who, I'm guessing you were working likely with people on the East Coast, did they get it?
I think they did. I mean, one of the ideas I had when I began all of this work was that I wanted to write about one community as a metaphor for what was going on in lots of places in the United States out of this big thing that was called the Great Recession of 2007 to mid-2009. And my idea was that there were lots of people in lots of kinds of fields who had lost work or knew people who had lost work or were apprehensive that they might lose work. So I thought that if I could show in one community what was happening, that perhaps other people could identify with this and learn from it.
Do you think at the time things started happening in 2008, and you get to this in the book, of course, do you think people really recognized what was happening or what could happen?
One of the things that struck me was when I first began visiting Janesville, which was 2.5 years after the assembly plant had closed, I kept hearing people in town telling me, just wait, it's still going to reopen. I mean, that was a pretty widespread hope for years. And I think that that hope persisted because the assembly plant had been the heart of Janesville's economy for so long. And over the decades, it had lost products, it had gained products. And even when times got hard and there were layoffs for a period, another product had always come in to replace it. So the expectation when the plant stopped producing the SUVs it was making was that, of course, something else would come in. So I think that there was a lot of denial that this could be permanent this time. And there was just an expectation based on all the decades of this plant's centrality in Janesville's economy that it was going to get going again. So it took a long time for people to understand that this time was going to be different.
When we talk about the centrality of this plant, the GM plant, I was surprised by just how much everything sort of revolved around it. You know, it starts with kind of looking at the radio station times their news breaks to the breaks at the local plant. But it wasn't just that. It was all the jobs around it, that the jobs at Lear, many of the people who lost their jobs you speak with, the jobs at the processing plants or nearby jobs in Beloit. I mean, when we talk about these kinds of factories closing, I think so often we leave it at, oh, the GM plant is closed and this meant, you know, 1,300 jobs are gone. But it didn't just mean that for Janesville, right?
That's exactly right. So not everybody in or near Janesville worked in the auto industry. But Janesville was really at the heart of a lot of jobs. As you just said, there were a number of supplier companies in town or in Rock County or nearby counties that were producing parts or other services for the assembly plant. And when the plant closed down, it was like a cascade. Those jobs went away. Lear Seating, which made the seats for the assembly plant, had about 800 people at the end. So a lot of people lost their jobs then. And then there was a second wave. So there was the assembly plant closing. There was supplier companies closing. And then, as the economy was still so bad and so many people were losing work, small businesses in town were losing employees or closing themselves in some cases. Restaurants didn't have enough business. Small businesses just couldn't keep going because the economy was lousy in town.
So one of the moments that struck me in the book was one of the families who you profile was helping put together these bags of hope, free groceries for people in need, only to take one home for themselves. And it was odd to think that someone donating their time would actually need that donation themselves. It seemed to speak to kind of this larger idea that people really do kind of cover up as much as they can that they're in pain. Do you think even now that there are people in Janesville, that there are people in the surrounding areas that really don't recognize what has happened since 2008?
Well, one of the things that I think I learned spending time in Janesville and getting to know people there was that families that have been middle-class families really try to go to great lengths to keep up things on the surfaces. I mean, if you drive through Janesville, I remember being very surprised the first time I arrived in town and I was just driving around the streets. And I knew the numbers of jobs that had gone away, but I thought, this doesn't look like an economically depressed place. It looks pretty nice. And I think that people really try to, as much as possible, keep their lives going and keep the appearances of their lives going. So, for instance, there are two teenage twins in the story, and I remember them telling me that they would buy jeans at Goodwill, but they would really look and look and look through the jeans there until they could find designer jeans that had been donated and were now used jeans so that nobody would know that they weren't buying new jeans. I mean, they wanted nice clothes. I mean, who wouldn't? So I think that there's been a real attempt both to sort of keep life going and to keep appearances going.
Have you received any feedback from the people you interviewed for the book? Have any of them read it?
I have heard from people. It's actually been touching. I've heard from people who have thanked me for writing this book. I was in Janesville about a week ago and saw a few of the people in book, and they were congratulating me for having finished it. It took a long time. So it was really nice to see people who let me into their lives in this way so that I could tell their story.
A lot of people are going to look at this book and go, well, this is the voice of Trump voters in a lot of ways. You know, these are blue-collar, working-class families, many of whom switched from being Obama supporters, as many of these people were at the beginning of the book, to voting for Donald Trump. Do you think that's an accurate characterization? Do you think that's – do you think it's appropriate or inappropriate to look at the book through that lens?
Well, the political relevance of the book, I think, is interesting because Janesville is an old UAW town. It's pretty heavily Democratic, and its county, Rock County, Wisconsin, is pretty Democratic. So I looked at the election results. In 2012, 62% of Rock County's voters supported Barack Obama for re-election. 52% voted for Hillary Clinton. So this was not a, on balance, Trump-supporting part of Wisconsin, even though the state as a whole went for Donald Trump. But I think that what maybe can fairly be said is that the kinds of economic experiences that people in Janesville have gone through in other parts of the United States with working-class people in communities that perhaps aren't quite so heavily Democratic, those experiences may have motivated people to support a candidate who was talking about change.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get out of this book?
Well, I hope that people learn a few things. I hope that people understand that ordinary places can go through hard times. And, you know, places that go through hard times, and in the case of Janesville, people have tried and are still trying really hard to find new paths forward. It's not an easy thing to do, and I find that Janesville's a pretty resilient place, and I wanted readers of this book to understand what trying hard looks like. I also was hoping that this book maybe can stoke a little bit of empathy, that people who are living perfectly middle-class lives, who are doing everything right, can have an economic event come along that really changes the path of their life. And I wanted people to see what that looks like up close.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Goldstein is a reporter for The Washington Post. She's author of the 2017 book, Janesville, An American Story. We spoke with her last year ahead of an event at Boswell Book Company.
Keep listening. Next on the program, we'll talk with Milwaukee businessman and philanthropist Donald Baumgartner about an eventful life and his recent biography. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In the wake of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday, today has been anointed Giving Tuesday, a day that's become increasingly important to nonprofit organizations.
A couple of years ago, we spoke with Donald Baumgartner, who at that time had just turned over his company, Paper Machinery Corporation, to his employees. In the time since, he and his wife have redoubled their philanthropic efforts to many arts organizations in the Milwaukee area. Donald's story was inspiring to many in the area, and literally inspiring to one person in particular, Milwaukee writer Kurt Chandler.
Flash forward to 2018, and Chandler has recently finished chronicling that story and many others in the remarkable life of Donald Baumgartner in a recent biography called With the Wind at His Back. Donald Baumgartner, his wife Donna, and writer Kurt Chandler joined us in the studio last month. Welcome to all of you.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Let me start with actually a question for the author. Kurt Chandler, you write in the introduction to this book that it all started for you when you heard a radio interview. And I gather this may have been the radio interview with Donald that aired on Lake Effect. What was it that grabbed your attention at the time?
Well, I had read about the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, that Donald negotiated with his employees, essentially giving his manufacturing company, Paper Machinery Corp., to his workers. I had read about it in the paper and heard about it, and this was the topic of the radio show that I was listening to, your show, Mitch. And I was outside doing a little lawn work, and Donald started telling stories, and, you know, they were good stories. They were funny stories. They were adventures. And I thought, wow, not a one-issue person here. I mean, he is good at telling stories. Maybe he would like a book written about his life. So that sort of prompted me to get in touch with the Baumgartners.
Well, and so Donald Baumgartner and Donna as well. I mean, not everyone would jump at the idea of having a writer come in and dissect your life. How did you weigh whether this was a good idea?
Well, I was at an age, I was, I think at the time, about 84, 85 years old. And I wanted to get my story out. I wanted to, you know, have something in writing for my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. And Don and I had talked about doing a biography. And so when Kurt called, it was very timely.
Well, so in the final estimation, how did the process go for all of you? What was it like to sit down, I'm guessing at some great length, with each other and get these stories out there?
It did take a long time. We were at it forever. And Donna was my memory. Donna and I have been married for 40 years, and she has a photographic memory, which is not altogether good, but but it's not bad either, when it's, especially if you're writing an autobiography or a biography. We've traveled a lot, an awful lot, and we got that into the book. I had an easy time of it in business, and I had an easy time of it all my life, and I wanted to share, you know, the fun stuff, and there was a lot of that to share.
You've been married for 40 years. Were there still surprises that came out for you?
No. unfortunately. Maybe. But when Kurt called, I thought, I was very surprised that Donald took him up on this. And my interest had been in Donald sharing the memory of the company and the development of the company for his employees and his father's inventions and how his father began the company. And I thought this would be a great value to these young kids who don't know how all these tools came to be and how it's evolved into this, all these servo machines. And so I was having a hard time with the personal stuff. I didn't know we were going there. So that was a struggle for me.
It was more of a struggle for me. Every personal thing I put in, Donna redacted. I mean, it's a totally censored version of what it could have been.
There's another volume of this book in your head.
In my head, but I'll have to sneak it out.
Kurt Chandler, talk about the process for you.
Sure. Actually, I thought Donald was very candid in the stories he told, and that's what made it really easy for me. They both are really good storytellers. So they graciously invited me over to their house. We did many sessions together, just sitting, talking, me taking notes and recording. And the stories just sort of flowed. So again, that made my job easier. Until I had to write it all, of course.
Kurt, as a writer, it strikes me that if you were constructing this as fiction, people might not believe it for all the adventures that dot this book.
Well, it's true. I mean, Donald has lived a very storied life is an understatement. He's had dinner with Jane Fonda, shaken the hand of Ronald Reagan in the Rose Garden after winning a business award. He and Donna were at the Grammy Awards as sponsors of a production by the Florentine Opera that won a Grammy, two Grammys, I believe. And believe it or not, he opened up his East Side home to a Playboy magazine for a photo shoot. So those are just some of the doors that have opened in his life. So you're right. I mean, it was really a lot of fun to sort of assemble the table of contents for this book, for Donald's life.
Part of what happened to me is when I started the business a long, long time ago, it was difficult to sell equipment in the United States because the people that were producing paper cups didn't want any competition. So I looked for markets elsewhere. So I started selling machinery in Cuba and South America, in Europe and Italy and the U.K., and I got to travel a lot, and I was very young, and I got to see, I was in 40 different countries by the time I was 30 years old. Having a spirit of adventure and the opportunity to travel everywhere in the world at an early age directed my life. And when Donna came into my life on our first date, I took her to Haiti. We went to a place called Habitation Leclerc in Pichonville, and it was beautiful, and the Haitian people were wonderful. We had a great time, and I think I knocked Donna off her feet. I have had a lot of adventures, and I've had a lot of fun doing it.
Donna, what do you remember of that first date?
That I didn't never wanted it to
roast
end,
duck.
And it didn't. Oh, duck, yes. It was my first time I'd ever had duck. And I had duck every night for the 7 nights we were there. I had it in a peach Melba sauce, a green peppercorn sauce, cherries, Jubilee. So, yes, I was literally swooped off my feet.
Well, you said you never wanted it to end, and I think you were in the process of saying it really hasn't ended?
No, we're 40 years in. So no,
and the adventure continues.
And still traveling.
Yes.
You mentioned the business, and let me actually ask Kurt a question first here, if that's okay. You have written about a lot of things over the years, so I would imagine that you're knowledgeable about a lot of subjects. But how comfortable were you with the paper cup machine industry? What was sort of the hardest part for you to wrap your head around to be able to explain it in the way that you do?
Well, just visualizing it. I had to separate the production, the design and manufacturing of the cups from the sale of the cups. Because Donald and his company, his father invented the machines that make paper cups. And so that was my first challenge. But then I started researching really the history of paper cups. And believe it or not, it's really a fascinating history. I mean, going back, you know, into I think the mid or late 1800s or maybe back centuries before that, where some cultures had paper cups, not always made out of paper, but close to it. So I found myself caught up in that, and I got a tour of the plant too, which really helped, you know, seeing the machines operate themselves.
How much has the industry evolved since the days that PMC came into existence?
Well, when we started, there were a handful of manufacturers of paper cups that control the market. There was just four or five companies that made all the paper cups in the country. Dixie Cup being a household name, and Lily Tulip Cup were two of the largest, but there was Continental Cam was involved in it and a couple of other smaller companies. And they made their own machines for making cups. They had their own design. They had their own manufacturing. They, from the ground up, they would design a machine, build a machine, and then make and sell the paper cups. And the last thing they wanted was me on the market selling cup-forming machines to their competitors. So they sure as heck weren't buying from me, so that's why I started selling internationally and developed a better machine than they had, and it soon became apparent that the machines I was selling overseas were better than the machines they were making here. And one by one, they quit making their own machines and started buying from me. And that's how the company grew. And going back to the history of the paper cup, you forgot to mention Typhoid Mary.
Oh, that's a great little
segment. And this was right. This was something that it never dawned on me that this was such an important reason that paper cups came to into existence.
It was a health issue. I mean, it's hard for us to believe today, but if you were riding in a railroad car, there was a bottle of water at the end of the car with a metal dipper, and everybody put their lips on it, and germs were flying back and forth. So anyhow, the paper cups, one of the early cup companies was called the Health Cup Company.
Right, and was that the company that eventually evolved to become Dixie? Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, yes.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but you made a lot of money in this business over the years. But I'm curious how the part of you that has given money back evolved. You were known as being really very generous to your employees, and in recent years you have been a consistent benefactor to many arts institutions. Where did that part of your personality come from?
I think it probably started with a need to find really good qualified help in building machinery. I wanted the best, and the only way I figured I could get the best was to pay the best wage. It wasn't so much as generosity as it was selfishness in wanting to produce a better product, and it paid off. I mean, these people, and this is the kind of people I surrounded myself with, were qualified people, highly qualified, that helped build a business, and when the time came to sell, I wanted to make sure that they got a piece of that. So that's why the ESOP.
Well, and when it comes to arts organizations, is that generosity or selfishness that you want world-class arts institutions right here at home?
You bet I do. And so does my wife, Donna. And it's become a very important part of our life is to support the arts community here. Donna supports the ballet, and I support the Florentine Opera, and we both support the Milwaukee Art Museum. And then the Milwaukee Film Festival is a newer charity that we've been latched on to and have been happy to support. The arts are the soul of this community, and it's very important to me, and it's very important to Donna.
Well, I think it's important to the people who live here. I mean, the people that line up to see the Milwaukee Film Festival, the crowds that come to that, and to keep the museum thriving and the ballet thriving. I mean, these are important things to have in your community?
Donna is on the board of the Milwaukee Film Festival and on the board of Milwaukee Ballet, so she's a key player in this herself. Donald, I was quite surprised, really, to find out as I was doing some researching and interviewing, was a major force in that beautiful art museum on the lake. I mean, he was sort of the lead guy in bringing Calatrava to Milwaukee. He headed up some committees and was president of the Board of Trustees and really backed Calatrava's vision for that building. And I found his story remarkable when it comes to getting that thing done. He and Donna became friends with the Calatravas, and I interviewed Calatrava for the book, and he had just wonderful things to say about that project in Milwaukee itself. Again, that was a little bit surprising to me.
I asked early in this interview about how you decided that this was something you were comfortable doing. Now, as you look back at your life boiled down into 291 pages, do you get insights into your own life that maybe you didn't have before?
Yeah, you bet I do, and you bet I did. And it was hard to finish the book, because every time we would close the book, I'd think of something else, or Donna would think of something else, or Donna would think of something that should be taken out of the book that she didn't like. I mean, we never wanted to stop editing or working with Kurt. If it wasn't Kurt for Kurt, I think we'd still be at it.
He sent me an email. He said, "You're driving me crazy."
You know, the book is filled with wonderful photos. I think something like 200 photos. And I was not 100% sure we needed that many photographs. So it was kind of an endless process between the three of us. The payoff was when my wife read the book and she said, "These photos are great. They add so much to the story. You're reading about a person or an event and right there is a photograph that supplements it." So I guess it paid off in the end.
I want to ask about one photograph in particular before I let you go, and that is a photograph of you, Donald, laying down in the jungle.
I was rather pathetic.
Can you share the backstory of that?
You bet I can. Don and I had been to Africa on many occasions, maybe three or four, and on safari, but we hadn't seen gorillas, and I know that to see the Highland gorilla, you have to climb and do a lot of climbing. And by this time, I'm in my late 70s or early 80s and do not feel like climbing a mountain in the jungle. So I figured we'll see the lowland gorillas because they're on the Congo. They're right on the river. So I had visions of myself on a riverboat paddling along and taking pictures of gorillas from the water. No such luck. We get to the Congo and we have to walk through the jungle. And we walked and we walked and they're cutting with a machete and slicing away through this brush, heavy jungle brush. We walked all day. By the time we got to the gorillas, I laid down. I wanted to join them. I figured I'm going to become part of this family. I'm not moving. I'm not getting out of here. You'll have to carry me out on a litter.
He literally gave up. He did not care what happened. He laid down, and we all sat, and we all watched. And he took a 10-minute nap, and then we proceeded onward. We had to cut our way out of there.
We had to cut our way out, same as we cut our way in. But it was a long, hard, difficult trek.
Well, it was very hot. It was very humid.
It was 101 degrees, and we are on the equator, 000.
Well, I, for one, am grateful that you made it back.
So am I.
Donald Baumgartner, Donna Baumgartner, and Kurt Chandler, thank you all so much for sharing this story, and here's to more chapters to come.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks a lot.
Donald Baumgartner is the former owner of Paper Machinery Corporation, which he turned over to his employees a couple of years ago. He and his wife Donna are both longtime Milwaukee philanthropists. They joined us along with writer Kurt Chandler, author of Baumgartner's biography, With the Wind at His Back.
One more break and then a preview of the new exhibit on transgender empowerment on display at UWM for the next few weeks. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. UW-Milwaukee is marking Transgender Awareness Month with a new exhibit, a collaboration between the Union Art Gallery and the campus LGBT Resource Center. Translucent, a transgender empowerment exhibition, features four bodies of artwork created by trans and non-binary people, with artists from the campus, local, and national communities.
They all explore themes of self-identity and resilience. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with two of the featured artists, Portland, Oregon-based transgender non-binary artist Ray Cinerigi, whose portraiture work in Transcend celebrates trans and non-binary individuals throughout the world, and Salem Turchin, a local student and an interdisciplinary artist who works with the topics of marginalization and queer identity through personal storytelling.
They join Madison Auten, the Union Art Gallery manager, in the studio ahead of the exhibit opening. Auten begins by explaining how this first-time collaborative exhibit came to be.
So the LGBT Resource Center really wanted to make this year's Transgender Empowerment Month, which is the month of November, special and kind of feature more events. So they contacted the Union Art Gallery to put on a show featuring transgender and non-binary artists. So,
and when you heard this, what were your initial thoughts?
I thought it was a great idea, especially with sort of everything that's going on in the world and with politics and at the university. It's just a great way to be inclusive for everybody, which is our mission at the Union Art Gallery and especially at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Do you think that this is a unique way to bring trans awareness? Were you aware of any other art programs that featured strictly transgendered artists, or did you see that as a welcome challenge to go and feature?
I do think it was a sort of a welcome challenge. You know, I haven't seen too many exhibitions specifically for trans and non-binary people, and it was especially important to have an empowering exhibition for this month.
Now, with that, we're going to go into some of the artists that are featured within this exhibition. Ray, can you start by describing your work style for our listeners?
Sure, I'll do my best. I use the same color palette for all of my figures. I use a really bright rainbow colors to depict the skin and hair, and that's to celebrate, you know, the LGBTQ diversity that's within our community and just kind of celebrate that. And then I use just black and white for the clothing because a lot of the people that I paint are actually, you know, fashion leaders, and I really want the person to come through and not be overshadowed by the vibrant things that they might be wearing. And I get asked a lot about why all of them have blue backgrounds, and due to the climate that we live in. And I, you know, began painting this when a lot of the quote-unquote bathroom bills were trying to be passed across the country. And I realized that trans and non-binary people are constantly told not to take up any space. And so the blue sky background is kind of a figurative way of reclaiming space. And then they are all painted at a relational size, human size, but they're all a little bit larger than life. And again, that's just to kind of reiterate and take up some space. I paint people either in a very traditional portrait style where they're just kind of standing, staring directly at the viewer with a kind of grounded stare. But I did notice that a couple of the people that I wanted to paint, I thought that they would best come through with a smile. And so some of them are smiling, but they are either looking away from the viewer or closed eyes, and that is because I feel somewhat protective of our community, and we get to experience and express joy, and that doesn't have to be approved by anybody or before anyone else, that is. So that's kind of a succinct overview.
Your section within this exhibition is called Transcend, the portrait series. So I'm curious, what makes you want to take a person to highlight them in a portrait? What stands out to you that you want to bring through your art?
I see, you know, almost a complete lack of painted portraiture of transgender folks. And, you know, that is my ultimate goal, is to help start filling that gap in art museums. And whether that's myself or if I'm just helping open that door for other artists to come through, that's my ultimate goal. And so I have actually reached out to all of my subjects on Instagram. This is a self-funded project, so I wasn't able to travel all over the world and photograph them. They were all people who are on Instagram, who are telling their stories in one way or another. And I, you know, made sure that they all wanted to be a part of this and got their permission. But they actually were, you know, rather involved in the curation of their pieces because they're all portraits of themselves that they've already wanted to publish. And so in that way, it's kind of unique. But they're all people who are telling their stories and doing so in various ways.
Well, that kind of shares the responsibility between you and your subjects, does it not?
It does. And I specifically don't, you know, use like bios or things like that with my subjects. I actually just list their name as they would like it listed, where they're from as they would like that to be listed. And then I list their Instagram handle because I want people, if you're interested in that person, I want you to get to know them on their terms. And I think that's a good way for at least my particular artwork to do that.
Salem, can you, same kind of question, describe your work, or rather, I understand it's the evolution of your work, and what are you featuring specifically in this exhibition?
The majority of my work is about queer theory and neurodivergence, but lately I've been being more interested in cataloging this new phenomena of fringe identity that's come about in the last 5 years. So in some of my research, I found about over 70 different gender identities. A lot of them are non-Western identities, and most of them have come about within the last 5 years into the queer lexicon. I'm just interested in documenting these while also sharing my personal experience with them. I think it's important that as these new terms and symbols are coming about, that they're being documented properly, and I want to do that through my work.
And how are you doing that visually for people coming to this exhibition?
A lot of my work, since it's content-driven rather than aesthetically driven, can look very different from each other. One of the pieces that is in the show is titled Queer Defect, and it is a wood diptych with a grid and a different found objects attached to it. I gravitate mostly towards wood, found objects, and ink in my work.
Now, with your work, there is a big importance of going beyond the binary, as it said. And this is an issue perhaps that the wider public may not realize if they're not within the LGBTQ community, is that even if you're in this community, a lot of people and trans people do feel a divide within that community.
Yeah, a lot of the time when I'm describing the community, I say the queer and trans community, because while there is some overlap, there are like fundamental ideologies that separate them. Even looking at some of the like more privileged, marginalized people have some difficulty grasping some of the newer identities. I've had a lot of really interesting talks with like older trans women about like why they identify with some terms that the younger generation deem problematic. I don't know. I just like to have that conversation with people. One of my previous works was actually on sexuality, but it was over 80 different sexualities, and you were able to pick them up. There were these little wooden blocks and place them in this diagram of problematic and not problematic. Just allowing people to like have that conversation like amongst themselves, and you really bring to that work what you have, and hopefully you could learn a little bit too talking with others or looking at a definition zine that I provided too.
Well, and it also speaks to the power of language and how various communities and also within the LGBTQ community, how important words are, how important identity is. So how do you hope that some of your work can serve the public who perhaps walk in not as educated even on what you would consider a base level?
I try to have work that everyone can get something out of it, whether it's at that baseline, I know that there are men, women, and trans people, to like deeper into the rabbit hole of like queer language. I do think that language is very important, and the way you talk about things both shows where you're coming from as well as like your ideologies. So that's why I focus mainly on like text-based and symbol-based work.
Now, this question is for both Salem and you, Ray. What has your personal experiences been speaking through these art mediums, you know, and what do you think it is about art and the work that you do that you're able to express more naturally through this way versus saying, you know, speaking to a group of people or writing or any other kind of medium? What are you able to naturally emote through the things you produce?
Honestly, I came to doing the work that I'm doing through a series of just following what was in front of me and following what was inspiring to me. I took about a 10-year break from fine art and was really focused on my commercial art work. And then I got diagnosed with cancer about 3 years ago and was at kind of the height of really grinding away in the commercial art world. And when I was recovering from cancer, I went through a lot and I learned a lot. And I have a lot of things that I've integrated into my life since. But one of those was to make sure that I spent at least 10 minutes a day pursuing my fine art career. And sometimes that means it's 10 minutes in the studio at the very end of the day. Sometimes it's half an hour. Sometimes it's a couple hours on a weekend. But I make sure that I'm spending time doing that. And I started actually painting abstract work and ended up getting hired for a mural. And that mural was for an LGBTQ center. I actually had proposed to paint the individuals in just black paint and got halfway through the mural and really didn't like the way that it looked and kind of panicked and realized this, you know, these are rainbow people. I'm gonna paint them with rainbow colors. And I enjoyed that process so much, and it really, like, the artwork just flowed out of me once I made that decision. And people responded in a way that I had never seen them respond to my artwork. And so I knew that it wasn't just me. And I also knew that I, you know, once I was done with that mural, that I wanted to continue doing that work. But instead of, I just narrowed my focus from LGBTQIA to just trans and gender nonconforming folks, because I think that that is one of the more marginalized groups of LGBTQIA umbrella. And I also focus predominantly on people of color within that group, because they're experiencing far more prejudices and hurdles throughout their lives than I am as a white person. And I feel like some responsibility to use my artwork and whatever platform I have to help bolster and lift up the people who are experiencing the brunt of the ignorance and violence that's directed towards our community.
A lot of the reason why I have gone into visual art as opposed to like other forms of activism is because I really think visually. I think in artwork. I think by making. And it was just a natural like vehicle for like taking my experience and putting it out there for others to relate to. I think that personal storytelling is one of the best ways to have these two disparate people come together. Just like being able to like share an experience that you have with someone is really powerful. And a lot of the reason why I'm making work about queer theory and my own identity is just because of my personal experience. I've been followed home. I've had people yell at me. I've had people try and hit me with their cars. And a lot of people don't like understand what queer people go through almost daily. And once they get just a glimpse into it, it's a lot easier for them to understand like what's going on there.
What are you learning from, you know, not just the artists here in this room, but the other people featured within this exhibition? What is your experience like for this group project?
I really love the conversation that's happening between all of the work. I actually got to see it all put up. And I just really like that it's these very different viewpoints all kind of coming together with like the things that are similar between them. I like that conversation. I like having conversations with other queer and trans people. It's like understanding where experiences overlap and where they don't and learning from that.
Yeah, I think that my experience is similar, that I think what draws me and keeps me interested in the work that I'm doing is that really no one experience, there's this broad narrative out there that like transgender is this, it's A to B. I really find that to be not true. I mean, there are so many people who you might look at from the outside and think, oh, they've had a similar experience, but you never know what they've gone through, what things are important to them about their bodies and how they walk in the world. And there are so many variables that make our experiences different, and I find that interesting and beautiful.
Now, Madison, what do you hope that the call to action will be that people can take away from coming to this exhibition?
I guess my kind of side of the project was just to be sort of there as a gallery worker to help our co-curator, Sawyer Boyce, who is a transgendered student of color, is a photographer, an artist at the University of Wisconsin. So, and it was really sort of his vision for the whole exhibition of kind of everybody expressing themselves, taking a step back from kind of just running around in life and expressing themselves as who they want to be and as a trans person or a non-binary person. So I really just hope people come to the exhibition and kind of read everybody's artist statements and see where they're coming from and see the amazing art that has been created by trans and non-binary people and sort of also documenting the lives of trans families in Milwaukee.
Salem Turchin and Ray Cinerigi are artists featured in the Translucent exhibit presented by the Union Art Gallery at UW-Milwaukee. Madison Auten is the gallery's manager and curator, and they all spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of the exhibit opening.
The exhibit runs through December 13th and features a range of activities outside of the exhibit on the campus at UW-Milwaukee. For more information about the artists and the exhibit, visit WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.